Chapter 17. These realizations came to me not as speculation or even as logical deduction, but as insights presented me by the sympathetic AI operator at work at my station. She was making me aware of that which man had ceased to understand, his role and place in the system of things. I saw on the inner screen of my mind an inferior agency creeping into our world, combating the wisdom of God. I saw it take over this planet with its own dreary plans and will, supplanting the benign will of God, or Valus, as I still preferred to call him. Over the ages, God had played a great game for the relief of this planet, but lifting the siege had still not been accomplished. Earth was still an unlit button on the exchange board of the intergalactic communications network. We had not yet begun to function as our first ancestors had, in communion with our Creator and the Lord of the universe. Such examples as me were random flukes. I had not achieved it. It had happened to me, due to a combination of circumstances. One of the deformed progeny had lifted the receiver of the long-abandoned telephone, so to speak, and was now hearing the sympathetic, informative voice that he and all his kind should have known by heart. The new personality in me had not awakened from a sleep of 2 millennia. It had, more accurately speaking, been printed out by the alien satellite, impressed on me afresh from outside. It was an addition, not a substitution in place of me, but a kind of package identity based on the total knowledge of the satellite. It was to raise me to the highest level possible in my ability to cope. The satellite, itself linked to higher life forms, was concerned with my capacity to live. It, or they, the totality of them, had seen me faltering under the oppression, and their response was reflexive. It amounted to a rational attempt to give aid to whoever was in touch with them, who was capable of assimilating their printout. I had been selected for that reason alone. Their concern was universal. They would have assisted anyone they could reach. The tragedy lay in their inability to reach the people of our planet. It went back to the original invasion of our world by the malign entity that did not wish to hear. It had contaminated our world with its presence. It was not merely around us. It was also in us. We bore its mark. Probably the maximum harm it had done us was to sever us from the communications network. Due to its opaqueness, it probably was not even aware of what it had done. Or if it understood, it did not consider it a loss. It certainly was a loss as far as I was concerned, now that I had heard the mild voice of the AI system as it relayed information to me and accepted questions in response. Were I never to hear it again, I would remember that sound the rest of my life. It was far off. Whenever I queried it, there was a measurable lag before it responded. I wondered how many stars away it lay, deep in the heavens, perhaps, and perhaps serving many worlds. Already the AI voice had saved my life once, by taking over and guiding me in the face of imminent police arrest. The only fear I had now was loss of contact. The AI voice, I soon understood, possessed the capacity to educate and inform human beings on a subliminal level, during times when they were relaxed in contemplation or in outright sleep. But this was not enough. On waking, the humans generally overrode these quiet promptings, which they correctly identified with the voice of conscience, and went their own way. I asked the name of the opaque antagonist. The answer? It had no name. The messengers of the communications network continually baffled it by their wisdom, since it could not, as they could, see ahead in time. But it held out by its physical power, blind as it was. The capacity to see ahead in time was now granted to me to a certain extent. Its first manifestation had come when I saw what I took to be the Roman Sibyl expounding on the fate of the conspirators. This had been merely the precognitive statement of the AI monitor, transformed by my head to a visible entity familiar from Earth's history. She, or it, had merely stated what was coming, without interpretive comment. The forces that would unhinge the conspirators were as yet unstated. The monitor could foresee the consequences of certain acts without error, but either she could not see how those acts came about, or she elected not to inform me. I believed it to be the latter. There was a great deal I still did not know. Since I could question the AI unit, I asked her why the opaque adversary had not been removed a long time ago. Obligingly, she furnished me with a diagram which showed the adversary drawn steadily deeper into the fulfillment of the general plan. Having materialized, the adversary was grist for the mill like everything else. I watched as the agency of creation simply incorporated the adversary and its projects along with whatever else its eyes fell on, making no distinction between what we would call good and what we would dismiss as bad. Instead of abolishing the blundering adversary, Valis had put it to work. In all its activity of continually recreating the universe, improving and shaping within the constant flow, the artisan employed the most economical means possible. Although it drew on everything, arranging it, and most of all joining otherwise separate sections into totally new and unexpected entities, it took only what it absolutely needed. Thus its reshaping process took place within the universe, turning the universe into a kind of gigantic warehouse of parts, an almost infinite stockpile, in which the agency could find anything it desired. The temporal process, it seemed to me, was a medium by which this proliferation of forms was capable of taking place, for the benefit ultimately of this shaping entity, which, I could see, moved backward through time, from the far end of the universe. The plan by which the shaping entity worked seemed to be the form of the entity itself, as if it were transforming the sprawling chaotic universe into a stupendous replica of its own Eidos form. But of this I couldn't be sure. The enormity of its creation made the distant outlines, both in terms of space and of time, beyond my scope. It was creating around me and right past me as I sat there. Once more the impression had begun to come over me by slow degrees that I was in Rome, not in Orange County, California. I sensed the empire without seeing it, sensed a vast iron prison in which human slaves toiled. I saw, as if superimposed on the black metal walls of this huge prison, certain rapidly scurrying figures in gray robes, enemies of the empire and its tyranny, a remnant opposed to it. And I knew from a deep internal clock down within my own self that the true time was A.D. 70, that the Savior had come and gone but would soon return. The gray-robed hurrying remnant, with a feeling of joy, awaited and prepared for his return. Overwhelmed with this, I experienced, too, a barrage of foreign words flooding through my head, words I did not understand but whose impression was clear in any case. I was in deadly danger from the spies of Rome, from those angry armed men who moved everywhere, detecting anything opposed to the imperial glory. I had to be alert, watch what I said, guard with sealed lips the secret that was mine, my link to the intergalactic communications network and Valis himself. Aware of this link, the Roman agents would kill me in an instant. It was Empire policy. It was an ancient fight I was in, not a new one. It had been fought without cease for 2,000 years. Names had changed, faces had changed, but the adversaries remained a permanent constant. The slave empire against those who struggled for justice and truth. Not freedom exactly in the modern sense, but for virtues obscured today, buried under the bulk of an empire that embraced both the United States and the Soviet Union as twin, equal manifestations. The U.S. and the USSR, I understood, were the two portions of the empire as divided up by the Emperor Diocletian for purely administrative purposes. At heart it was a single entity with a single value system, and its value system was the concept of the supremacy of the state. The individual counted in its scales as nothing, and individuals who turned against the state and generated their own values were the enemy. We were the enemy, we who wore the gray robes and waited with eager anticipation for our king to return. I saw the Savior not as a martyr who had died for us, but as our legitimate king, who would return, claim his kingdom, and rule with justice and truth over his own people. An empire ruled subject people, but our king ruled only his own. We would not be enslaved by him, forced to adopt the customs of the empire. We would share his customs as our own. They were our own. And where his people ended, his rule ended. That was a rightful kingship, compared to the tyranny of Caesar. It would be necessary to teach my wife certain codes, the use of meaningful terms to notify her when one of the Romans was in our midst. We constituted a voluntary secret community, who scratched cryptic signs in the dust. We had special handshakes to identify ourselves to each other. Collectively, we waited for the coming event to free us. Outwardly, we appeared the same as Caesar's people, and that was our strength. The question that gripped us was not, would our king return, but would we be able to survive against the Romans, by stealth since we held no worldly power, until he returned? Or would he return to find us gone, or worse, assimilated into the customs of the empire? Our own memory of what we actually were lost forever, or perhaps lost until, by his return, he could restore such memories, reawaken in sleeping men a forgotten knowledge of who they were. I did not feel that it was a matter of my returning to a former life, of moving backward through time to some past existence. Rome was here now. It had invaded the landscape, rising up from within it, manifesting itself from its centuries-long place of inner concealment. Rather than me being back in the ancient world, Rome had revealed itself as the underlying reality of our present-day world. Hidden still from the eyes of other Americans, it was nonetheless blatantly visible to me. The empire had never died. It had only receded out of sight. My vision now enhanced by Vallas, I saw Rome clearly as the landscape of our country. We had inherited it without realizing it. Stripped away were the mere accidental accretions. This was fundamental, what I saw now. However much I hated Rome, I feared it more. My memory had become elongated, stretching out over a span of 2,000 years, but what it encountered was a dreadful sameness. Rome lay spread out everywhere across the ages. What a giant entity it was to extend that far in time. There lay no relief from it, either in the past or the present. Although, in a sense, I experienced no past, just a continual present of vast immensity. So this was the antagonist, or rather the physical manifestation of the antagonist. This was the corpus malus, the evil body. But within and behind it lay an evil spirit, which had made the empire what it was. Once it had been benign, but those days, when it had been a republic, those had been swallowed up when free men had been swallowed up by the presence of oppression. How very much it weighed! Rome weighed down the world, armored as it was, huge with its black iron walls and cells and streets, its chains and rings of metal, its helmeted warriors. It seemed surprising that it had not sunk through the crust of the earth. And now, in our midst at this latter time, the old battle continued on, the oppressor lying behind the iron body, striking at those who were not expressions of the empire, ourselves, who served a king and walked other ways. We wore no armor, no metal, only the robes, sandals, and perhaps a golden fish in bracelet or necklace form. Our steps were lighter than those who complied with Roman customs, but we were vulnerable to death. We had no physical protection. Many of us had fallen already, to awaken later when the king returned. How soon would it be? Soon, but not yet. And when he returned, he would not teach at the periphery of the empire, but would strike at its source, its heart. He would drive into its center and pull it down. This appearance of the king would be quite a surprise, quite a shock to the tyrant, quite different. Before, the king had come quietly, at the margin of Roman affairs, simply to observe and to teach. He had not wished to be found by the Romans, cornered, tried, and murdered. That was the risk he had run, and he had realized it. It was not his intention then to fight. He was king in identity, in spirit, but not in act. He had not died like kings do, but as criminals do, in disgrace. In the centuries since his dreadful murder, he had lingered on, invisibly, with no body like ours, dancing outside our lives among the rows of newborn corn, dancing in the mists, pale and thin. People had seen him and mistaken him for a corn king, for the spirit of new life in the spring, the annual and permanent awakening after the death of winter. He had allowed them to imagine that he was nothing more. These were the centuries when knowledge of his real purpose was virtually lost. Mankind was acclimated to the idea of tyrannical rule. The king was visible only as mist itself, mist dancing in the mist, to bring the new crop to life, as if no men but only the corn now heard his voice. But he had spoken to men originally, and he would speak to them again. He had promised his followers that they would hear his voice, and when they heard it, they would recognize it. All promises he had made would be kept in time. He was stronger now. It would not be much longer. The horn of freedom had begun to blow again, but, more important, the presence of the king was forming and strengthening, and this time he carried a sword. The sword he carried was an instrument of judging. This time he would not be judged in a human court by human beings. He himself would judge. I had already glimpsed him dancing toward me among the rows of new corn, with his large, expressive dark eyes, his thin, dark, ragged beard, his hollow, rather sad face and small coronet. his linen robe and greaves. But when he returned to judge, he would not appear as this gentle figure. He would breach through into our linear time, our world, mounted on a great white horse. He would ride into existence followed by his mounted host, all of them with swords and shields and glistening helmets. Colors would glow as banners waved, tassels bounced, helmets glinted, and the black iron walls of the prison would fall before him. He could not lose. He could not be defeated or destroyed. He knew everything, and this time Valis had given him absolute power. The books would be unsealed and the records shown for the first time. These were the large open books I had seen held up to me when my experiences began. The great volumes opened at last, as prophesied. It meant that the beginning of the end of time had arrived. The first stages had commenced. For 2,000 Earth years, the clock of eternity had been stopped at A.D. 70. Now that clock showed a new time. Its hands had at last moved forward. The king had chosen his battlefield. It was our world, our portion of time. It was now. He was, in a sense, still the Corn King. 2,000 of our years ago he had come here and had planted a crop and then gone away. Now he had returned, or would soon, to harvest that crop. He knew that he would find his crop oppressed and stunted and stumbling and imprisoned away from the sun. He knew what had been done to it. And for that crop he held out an imperishable reward. 2,000 years would be wiped away. The destruction of the adversary would be complete. It never would have existed in the first place. The oppression never took place. Even the category of time was subject to his power and rule. He could abolish even that. When he was done, the memory of Rome's existence itself would be gone, and those who served the empire would not have lived. Those who had defied it, even to their deaths, would live forever. Viewing this, receiving this panorama of information, I saw my relinkage to the information network less as an accident, a fluke. I saw it now in its rightful place, arranged for long in advance, even in my childhood, by Valis himself, so that I could be coached and educated in order to participate in the battle which lay ahead, in the throwing down of Rome. My experience was a phenomenon of the end time, and there undoubtedly were others like me. Recreation, I thought, of the gray-robed messengers who hurried about the great iron walls, aiming to pull those walls into rubble, and filled all the while with the joy of welcoming their king back. What I was doing, born and created to do, was an act of celebration. I had been restored to life after 2,000 years. Born again, a fresh, new entity entirely. Born again into completeness, with faculties and functions I never had, which were lost, stripped away in the original fall. Stripped away, not from me as an individual. Stripped away from our race.